Then the Portuguese left. He talked about corpses hanging in the trees, about men castrated and fetuses hanging out of the slit bellies of women, and, like the Greek, about cattle with their legs cut off. He abandoned all his mineral claims, dynamited his hunting camps, not even the stones were left in one piece, and came to South Africa to start over. I wondered what I'd think if I were South African and looked at the rest of Africa and saw nothing but oppression, murder, chaos, massacre, impoverishment, famine, and corruption, whereas in South Africa there was just some oppression and murder. "You think the blacks can't govern themselves?" I said to Carlo. He shrugged.
"It was the East Germans, the Cubans, who did the worst things I saw. You know Jonas Savimbi?"
he said, naming the head of the more or less pro-Western United Guerrillas fighting Angola's Marxist government.
"I would cut my arm off here to put Savimbi in power."
And he pointed to the same place on his limb as the cattle had been mutilated on theirs. South Africans drink and get nostalgic. I spent the Christmas holidays on the Indian Ocean in Scottsboro, a sort of Southampton or Hilton Head with its peak season at South Africa's midsummer Yuletide. There were a lot of old people there, members of the Winwe tribe, so-called because most of their sentences begin with,
"When we were in Nyasaland,"
"When we were in Bechuanaland,"
"When we were in Tanganyika."
It seems Africa was a paradise then, and the more that was drunk, the more paradisical it became, though it must have been an odd kind of Eden for some of its residents.
"You could see why the blacks steal,"
said one old man, ex of Rhodesia. He'd been captured by the Germans at Tobruk.
"In the POW camp at Breslau, we worked in the post office. Stole everything in sight. Only natural under the circumstances."
He flipped his cigarette out onto the lawn, the way everyone does in South Africa. There's always someone to pick up the butts.
"The only reason blacks have bones in their skulls is to keep their ears apart,"
said a startlingly ugly old lady, just as the maid, with expressionless face, was passing the cocktail weenies around.
"Now, wait a minute," I said.
"Well, of course your blacks have white blood."
The ugly woman shook her head.
"I've never understood how any man could be attracted to a black girl," she said, helping herself to several miniature Frankfurters and looking right through the very pretty maid. "That kinky hair, those fat noses, great big lips."
I would be drummed out of the Subtle Fiction Writers League if I invented this scene. The old woman was not only ugly with the ugliness age brings us all, but shows signs of formidable ugliness by birth. Pickle jar chin, mainsail ears, and a nose like a trigonometry problem. What's more, she had the deep frown and snit wrinkles which come only from a lifetime of bad character. All that day I'd been driving through KwaZulu, through the valley of 1,000 hills in the Natal outback, driving through little villages where the Zulu girls, bare-breasted to show their unmarried status, were coming to market. Burnished skin and dulcet features and sturdy little bodies like better-proportioned Mary Lou Rettons, I had fallen hopelessly, fervently, eternally in love 30 or 40 times. And the South Africans drink and grow resigned to fate. At least the younger ones do. At a dinner party full of junior business executives, the talk was about the olive-colored South African passport that most countries won't accept as a travel document.
"We call it the Green Mamba," said an accountant, "because you can't take it anywhere."
The guests discussed countries the way people their age in Manhattan discuss unfashionable neighborhoods where they might be able to find a decent-sized apartment.
"We're looking at Australia," said an estate agent. "Oh, Christ, England, I guess," said a law clerk from Tom's office. "My grandmother's English."
"The Florida option is what most people are thinking about," said an assistant hotel manager. "Same weather, strong economy, and that's where everybody else goes when their governments fall apart."
They didn't talk about money or careers. They didn't even talk about apartheid as much as we do.
"If the United States were serious about fixing the situation here," said the law clerk, "all they'd have to do is give every young professional in South Africa a green card. Nobody would be left."
At least nobody they knew very well.
"When you don't work with people and you don't live with people, you don't know them," said the accountant. "Just the help.
and the help's attitude lately has been, as they put it, shifting.
Who can blame them?
Said the law clerk.
They say it's those of us who've been moderates, said the estate agent, who'll have our throats cut.
What about the Afrikaners? Do you blame them? I asked. Helpless shrugs all around.
A lot of us are part Afrikaans, said the assistant hotel manager,
and he told a Fund Merva joke, the South African equivalent of a Polish joke, about an American, an Englishman, and Fund Merva, the Afrikaner. They can each have a wish. All they have to do is run off a cliff and shout their heart's desire. The American runs off the cliff and shouts, "Gold!" A pile of gold bars appears at the bottom of the cliff. The American falls on top of it, and he's killed. The Englishman runs off the cliff and shouts, "Silver!" A pile of silver coins appears at the bottom of the cliff. The Englishman falls on top of it, and he's killed. Then Funder Merva runs off the cliff, but as soon as he gets over the edge, he looks down and yells, "Oh, shit!" A huge pile of shit appears. Funder Merva lands in that and walks away unscathed. Those Afrikaners drink a lot, too, though it looked like just plain drinking as far as I could see. I spent an evening in a dirty little bar in a farm town called Humansdorp in the Cape Province. At first, I didn't think the locals even noticed I was there. Then I realized they had all been speaking Afrikaans when I came in, but after they heard me ask for more ice in my whiskey, they switched their conversations into English, still not saying a word to me. The bartender regaled one customer with the details of a practical joke he'd played, putting cayenne pepper in somebody's snuff. The rest of the bar was trading stories about bad and foolish black behavior. A kid who'd just gotten back from his 2-year army hitch was saying that Namibian girls smear menzies mixed with mud all over their bodies. For all I know, it's true, but no weirder than some of the ingredients I've noticed in my girlfriend's shampoo lately. Somebody else said he kept building houses for his farm families, and they kept tearing holes in the roofs to let out the smoke from their cooking fires. There was concerned clucking over the neighborhood black teens. After they're circumcised, they're supposed to spend a month alone in the bush, but instead they spend it begging beside the highway. Finally, one of the Afrikaners turned to me and asked about sheep farming in the United States. By that time, I'd had enough to drink to tell him, although I don't believe I know which end of a sheep you're supposed to feed. Then, everyone wanted to have a chat. Was it difficult figuring out the South African money? There are 100 cents to the rand. Did people try to deal, cheat, you around here? Does America have a lot of blacks?
I want to go to America, said the young ex-soldier, to see how you do it.
Do what? Get along with the blacks.
What a strange place America must be. Land of sanctuary for all beleaguered oppressors, with simple money and endless sheep farming opportunities, where blacks behave somehow, because they've got white blood. Mike Butcher, the NBC correspondent in Joburg, told me his baby's nurse, a beautiful girl of 19, wants to go to Harlem because everybody is young and rich there, and because no one in Soweto has enough cows to pay her bride price. Mike said he tried in vain to tell her most guys in Harlem don't have a lot of cows. And in the Transkei homeland, I talked to a black divinity student who'd visited America.
The most wonderful place, he said. So wealthy and beautiful and with perfect racial harmony.
What part of America did you visit? I asked.
The south side of Chicago.
I was pretty drunk myself by the time I'd been in South Africa for 3 or 4 weeks. Not that I'm not usually, but there was something white African in this bender. I was fuddled, my head boiled with clichés. I was getting used to being confused. I was getting used to hearing the most extraordinary things. From this Irish couple, who'd been living in Africa for 3 decades, for instance.
There hasn't been apartheid here for years, said the wife.
One of the problems is that that word was invented, said the husband.
I was becoming South African, used to having people all around me, all the time, doing everything for me, and not doing it well. I went in to dinner at my resort hotel in Mosselbaai, on the spectacular Big Sur-like garden route along the coast between Port Elizabeth and Cape Town.
I'd had my 6 or 8 whiskies with the Irish couple in the lounge and was ready for one of the elaborate, big, bland, and indifferently cooked meals that constitute South African cuisine. The restaurant was turned out in red plush and crisp linen. Candles glittered in cut glass sconces. But when I sat down at my table, there were 3 teaspoons, 2 water glasses, 1 dirty wine glass, no forks, no knives, and no napkin. "I need a dinner fork, a salad fork, a knife, and a napkin," I said to the waiter, who stared at me in dull surprise, and then headed out across the dining room at the speed of a change in seasons. His feet were sockless below the tuxedo pants, and he was standing on the backs of his shoes, with just his toes stuffed into the unlaced Oxfords. He returned with another spoon. "I need a knife, a fork, and a napkin," I said. He came back 20 minutes later with the water pitcher and filled my wine glass. "Look here," I said. "Do you speak English?" He thought about that for a long time. "Oh, yes." He disappeared and came back in 1/2 hour with 1 more water glass. "Is the master ready to order?" He was without recourse, voteless, impoverished, unpropertied, not a legal citizen in his own nation, yet he had me reduced to a paroxysm of impotent drunken rage. I left him a huge tip and ate my chicken with a spoon. It's always hard to see hope with a hangover. Nowhere more so than at the butt end of this continent, in a country that's like a nightmare laundry detergent commercial. Makes whites whiter, coloreds brighter. They're building themselves a gigantic Cinerama Technicolor Ulster here. And the troubles in Ireland have been going on since my own relative, Tiernan O'Rourke, Prince of Breffni, had his wife stolen by Dermid McMurrah, King of Leinster, and O'Rourke got so mad that McMurrah had to call on Henry II of England for help. That was in 1152. I think we can expect the same swift and decisive resolution to the problem in South Africa. Divestment and sanctions. I guess those are the big answers proposed in the States. Well, economic sanctions sure nipped the Russian Revolution in the bud, made the Ayatollah Khomeini's Iran fold like a hideaway bed, and put Chiang Kai-shek right back in power on the mainland. The whole time I was in South Africa, I only talked to one person who was in favor of sanctions, and that was the divinity student in Transkei, who'd visited the south side of Chicago. He cited biblical example. When the Pharaoh hardened his heart, God had to find another way. But he also told me the Bible requires polygamy, so I'm not sure whether he was in Earth orbit or not. Of course, there were a lot of people I didn't talk to. The comrades, busy performing the necklace, that is, putting flaming car tires around people's necks, actually, down over their shoulders, in order to pin their arms to their sides, were hard to chat up, and I never bumped into Bishop Tutu. Most of the blacks I did talk to would be considered, by South African standards, middle class, even sellouts, Uncle Bantus. They told me political power grows from economic power. They saw sanctions as hurting one of the few black chances to get a leg up the ladder. I have no idea whether they were right or wrong. But when I was in Julundi, the administrative capital of the Zulu tribal lands, I was hanging around, drinking beer and talking to people, and a young political organizer leaned over to me and said, "It's really very simple why we are against sanctions. If we have money, we can buy guns." So maybe we should factor that into our next U.S. out of South Africa rally. The South African government's own solution, the homelands, is a hideous joke. I traveled through the Tswana tribal homeland, Bafu Tswana, in the north, KwaZulu in Natal, where the Zulus refused to accede to independence, and through the 2 Xhosa homelands, Transkei and Ciskei, along the Indian Ocean. They're all the same. Every place is littered with windowless huts that you couldn't tell from latrines, if there were any latrines to tell them from. The garden plots look like Grateful Dead fan beards. People are dumped into these rural wastes, far more people than the land can support. So the men have no choice but to go off to the rest of South Africa and work as foreigners. The homelands are on the worst land in the country, scorched foothills and prairies on the verge of desertification. Raw trenches of the red African soil have eroded in webs across the pastures. Every foot of ground is overgrazed.
The tribal economic system, like that of ancient Europe, is based on cattle. The word pecuniary comes from the Latin picus, cattle. The cows aren't often eaten or sold or even milked. They are the bank account, the measure of the clan's and the family's wealth. They're also an ecological nightmare in these cramped precincts. I used to have 8 head of Hereford beef cattle at my place back in the States. I asked some people in Jalundi what kind of wife these would get me.
"Oh," said one, "probably a girl who's lived in the city for a while and had a couple of kids."
"But," I said, "these are purebred polled Herefords, going 1,000 pounds or more."
"No, no, it's like rent notes. It's the number of cows that counts."
I did see one homeland that worked, beautiful and severe bushveld taken back from Boer farms and restored to its natural state with Blesbach and Gemsbach and Springbok bocking around all antlered and everything, and herds of zebra, Art Deco on the hoof, and packs or gaggles or whatever they're called of giraffes. An NBA of giraffes would be the right term. This was, however, a homeland for the animals, the Botsalano Game Park in Bafuthatswana. Tom Mills and I were riding in a Land Rover with his wife and 2 kids when we came right up beside 5 rhinoceri, 4 really enormous gigantic ones, and a calf that was pretty tremendously huge itself. It's not easy to describe the effect that the first sight of a wild rhino has on a not very brave author from Ohio. It's like taking your 4-year-old on a surprise visit to the Mesozoic era. I felt a vaulting thrill combined with some desire to start crying and crawl under the Jeep. Tom, in what I felt was an extremely foolhardy move, turned off the engine.
"There are 2 kinds of rhinos," said Tom. "White rhinos are fairly docile. They don't usually bother you, but black rhinos are very nervous and aggressive. They'll charge."
"These rhinos are gray," I said.
"White rhinos and black rhinos are actually about the same color," said Tom.
How do you tell them apart?"
"White rhinos have a square upper lip. The black rhinos is pointy."
I looked at our rhinos. Their upper lips were square in a pointy sort of way. "How else do you tell them apart?"
"I forget."
The rhinos, who are very nearsighted, finally noticed us. They cocked their heads in this Godzilla way they have and began to amble in our direction. A rhinoceros ambles at about 60 miles per hour. There was a moment of brief, but nonetheless high, drama, while the Land Rover engine went ugga, ugga, ugga before it caught. The rhinos made South Africa more depressing, if that's possible. The big game is disappearing from Africa. Most Africans have never seen a rhino in its natural state, which is a state of mild pique, I believe, any more than we've seen the prairie black with bison. And, to be fair, the white South Africans are the only people on the continent returning any land to the wild. Whatever's going to happen in South Africa will be bad for the rhino, too. And rhinos only occasionally kill for fun, and never go to the UN afterward and say they did it because of American imperialism or communist subversion. We drank as much as usual that night, sitting outside the tents with Botsalano's game warden. While baboons goofed off in the shrubbery and frogs sounded in the waterhole like 10,000 little boys with sticks on an endless picket fence, Tom's wife Sally talked about her father, an Edinburgh grocer who'd come out to South Africa when she was a little girl.
"He was looking for a healthier place to raise a family, where my sisters and I could grow up with more of a future than we'd have in Scotland."
The game warden told how the leopard was coming to extinction in South Africa. The leopards used to be hunted as trophies, mostly by Americans and Englishmen. Any farmer who had a leopard shot on his land received a trophy fee of several hundred rand. So whenever a farmer had a leopard around, he was careful to preserve it until some rich guy came looking to decorate the rumpus room. Even if this cost the farmer a few lambs or calves, it was worth it. Then the animal rights people, the bunny huggers, as the warden called them, got legislation passed forbidding the import of all spotted fur, including stuffed heads, into the U.S. and the U.K. Now the farmers just shoot the leopards, mothers, cubs, and everything, as pests.
"So fucking bloody much for good intentions," said the warden.
A couple days later, driving with Tom in his Mercedes sedan through the perfectly empty Sunday streets of Joburg, I put it to him about South Africa. There aren't that many Afrikaners. What, 3 million versus 2 million English and other real Europeans? And you guys control the economy, almost all the major industries, right?
Mostly, yes.
You've got the money, you've got 40% of the white vote, and you've got 24 million blacks, coloreds, and Indians who'd back you up. What's keeping you from taking the Afrikaner National Party and snapping its spine like a chopstick?
That's just not how the English are, you know, said Tom. Most of us aren't very political.
A couple of Chicago ward bosses and you'd have this country in your pocket.
I suppose people think it wouldn't be cricket.
I'd never heard wouldn't be cricket used seriously before. Interesting what cricket means if you think about it. Boring, insanely complicated, and riddled with snobbery and class. We'd pulled onto the N3 freeway. Joburg's office towers shone behind us. Flat-topped artificial hills from the gold mine tips rose in the distance. I was staring out the window at South Africa's admirable highway beautification when we came over a rise, and I caught a glimpse of what was beyond the screen of trees and shrubs. Thousands of tiny, slatternly huts were pressed together in a jumble, stretching for miles, and every one of these hovels seemed to be on fire. Smoke drifted in an ominous smudge across the highway. Riots, I thought, trying to fasten my seatbelt for the high-speed, evasive driving we'd have to do through hordes of angry comrades who would, no doubt, come roiling across the freeway at any moment, stones and firebombs in hand.
If you look over there, said Tom, you can see Alexandra. It's one of our older black townships.
Maybe he hadn't noticed it was on fire.
Isn't it on fire or something? I said.
That's from the cook stoves. They don't have electricity.
And then Alexandra slipped back behind the decorative landscaping and was gone. Tom and I had been out that afternoon shooting doves again with Connie, the Greek car dealer. We were shooting near Sharpeville, site of the famous 1960 massacre, a sleepy farm town, nobody's picture of a killing ground. All around were huge Afrikaner grain spreads, completely up to date and identical to big mechanized American farms, except they weren't going bankrupt, thanks in part to worldwide bans on selling grain to South Africa. But out in the middle of these homesteads, invisible from the pretty country roads, are the people who work the land. Their one-room, cinder-block, tin-roofed shacks are set in the fields with wheat growing right up to the doors, not even room for a garden, just a communal well in a muddy dooryard. There were half-naked kids all over the place. We took some of the kids along to run after the dead birds and pluck and gut them.
Curly-headed retrievers, the South Africans say.
The kids got a rand apiece, about 50 cents U.S., plus cigarettes. One of the boys, who said he was 15 but looked an undersized 12, was fascinated by Tom's Mercedes. He'd never been in a car before. Tom and I gave him a ride up and down the dirt track by his home. The boy kept sniffing and poking at the air conditioner vents.
"Where does the cold air all come from?"
he asked.
"I'm," said Tom, and looked at me.
"God, I don't know," I said. "Something gets heated and that, makes it cold." So much for the educational benefits of superior civilization. Tom flicked the electric sunroof switch to change the subject. The kid watched the roof panel slide back and forth.
"Now I've seen everything," he said.
Tom had a client named Gilead, a man of 60 or 70, who'd started out selling coal from a sack in the black townships and was now one of the richest men in Soweto. Save for a bit of melanin, Gilly was the image of my Irish grandfather, close-cropped hair, a build like a Maytag's, and fingers thick as my wrists. He even had the same gestures as my grandfather, pulling on the old-fashioned pointy lapels of his banker's striped suit, then planting his thumbs in the pockets of his vest and toying with the thick watch chain that ran across his belly. Gilly's skull bore 4 or 5 large hatchet scars from the gang quarrels of his youth. When I first met him, in Tom's office, he was telling about one of the stores he owns being offloaded by the comrades.
"The gangs, they set up at either end of the street, you know. They are just boys, some no more than 10 years old. Some of the boys come into your store and buy a pup, and then they throw the bottles around to create their diversion and begin to empty the shelves. and you just stay quiet if you don't want to be necklaced.
Yes, but you weren't in the store when that happened, said Tom.
Gilly began to laugh.
No, I was not in there the first two times it happened.
Well, he was in there the third time, said Tom to me, and he chased them down the street with his pistol.
Ho, 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 ho,
Gilly laughed and rocked back in his chair as though the comrades were the best joke in the world.
When I was young, there were guns everywhere in the townships, and these little fellas, all they've got are stones.
You know what we have to do? Said Tom when Gilly'd left. We have to get Gilly to come out to our house for dinner and bring his wife and some of his friends. It would be interesting for you to talk to them.
But the riots in Soweto kept anyone from getting in or out after dark, and even in the daytime, there were too many barricades and stonings to bring the women along. So Gilly and three of his black friends, young men in their 20s, came to an afternoon braai, a barbecue, at Tom and Sally's house. A Christmas week strike had begun in Soweto that day, and Gilly, Bob, Carswell, and Nick arrived in a rusted Datsun, although Gilly owns a BMW. We all sat on the patio for a stiff 20 minutes while the Mills' maid peeked around the doorpost with an expression of intrigued disapproval. But then a few beers were had, and the steaks and the Borrower's sausages began to spatter on the grill, and one more of the 100,000 endless discussions of South Africa's situation began. The strange thing is that when I look in my notes now, if I cover the names, I can barely tell who said what or if the speaker was black or white. Carswell, Bob, and me, I guess, favored one man, one vote. Gilly, Nick, Tom, and Sally felt Tom's idea about property qualification had merit. There was a general denunciation of the Group Areas Act, which dictates where what race can live, and of U.S. sanctions, too.
Politics is dirty, said Carswell, and there was unanimous disparagement of President Botha and Winnie Mandela.
Everyone agreed moderates would come to the fore if they just had a chance. Bob described, with considerable anger, how the riots and strikes in Soweto were controlled by anonymous pamphlets and unsigned ads in the Daily Sowetan. He blamed outside agitators, just like the Reagan White House does.
They call you up in the night, said Carswell, and ask what size tire would fit you.
We need more black police and black army forces, said Nick.
Nick, Bob, and Carswell had small children and were furious about the black school boycott. They said the ANC leaders were pushing a public school strike while the leaders' own children were being educated in private schools. They feared, they said, the intentional creation of a black underclass. Of course, there's one of those already, but anyway, everyone praised capitalism for a while, and Bob made a poetic appeal for whites to stay in South Africa, although perhaps he was just being polite in response to the hospitality. Then Nick said something that shocked me, and that I could see surprised Tom and Sally.
I'm angry that South Africa is singled out, he said. Why should Senator Kennedy come here and tell us our troubles? We're not the only country in the world where bad things happen.
I have just this one fear, said Carswell. Attacked from the outside, South Africa has no friends.
After the meal, Gilly waxed historical and told a horrifying story about seeing three men crucified by the Spoilers gang in Alexandria in the 1940s.
One man was still alive, nailed up to this post. He was screaming, but his mouth was dry and no sound came out. I will never forget it.
What are you guys going to do? I asked Nick, Bob, and Carswell. How are you going to get rid of apartheid?
Such meetings as this are valuable, said Carswell, as though something had been accomplished that afternoon.
That was a real eye-opener, said Tom when Gilly and his friends had left.
Incredibly interesting, said Sally. We've got to do that again.
And it dawned on me. They'd never had black people as guests in their house before.
We've seen Gilly and his wife at office parties, said Sally, and there are black and Indian students at the kids' schools. We've seen the parents at school functions.
We were going to the Fletcher's house that night for dinner.
Let's not say anything about this, said Tom. I'm not sure how Bill and Margaret would feel about it. They're a little old-fashioned about some things.
Yes,
said Sally. But at one that morning, When we were all good and drunk and passing around the Afrikaner Wits End brandy, Tom couldn't resist.
"You'll never guess what we did this afternoon," he said to Bill and Margaret. "You know my client Gilly, who owns all the stores. Well, we had him and some of his young friends out to a braai. They had some extraordinary things to say. It was a real eye-opener."
"Incredible," said Bill.
"What a great idea. We ought to do that, Margaret, with some of my subcontractors. That's a great idea."
"We really should," said Margaret.
I had the most peculiar feeling in my woozy haze. I was present at the birth of a fundamental, epical realization of human fellowship, but I was sure the birth was coming too late to save the baby. I'd walked Gilly out to the Dotson when he was leaving Tom's house, and he took me by the arm and said,
"Apartheid is the evil thing. Apartheid must just stop. If those laws are removed, no more policemen will be needed."
He glanced toward Tom and Sally.
"They all know it's wrong,"
I said. "They don't seem to know how to get rid of it."
"They know," said Gilly. "They just don't want to give up the advantage they have on the black man."
"Is it too late?" I said.
"What man does, man can fix."
"Maybe." On my last day in South Africa, I drove through Soweto. Probably not a good idea for a person as putty-colored as myself in a shiny red rent-a-car. Also, it was illegal. No white person is allowed to go there without government permission. Even white police and soldiers don't enter Soweto unless the situation gets so out of hand they think they have no choice. But I'd been in South Africa for a month and had not met one white person who'd been there. It's just outside Joburg, a huge adjunct, taking up the whole southwestern quadrant of the city's outskirts. But I hadn't talked to any white person who'd ever even seen Soweto. And then I couldn't find the place. A city of 2 million people, and when I looked at my rental car map, it wasn't there. I drove around the N1 Beltway, and there were no signs, no exits marked Soweto. I got off in the southwest and headed in what I thought must be the right direction. I took a couple of gravel roads, navigating by the sun. Finally, I saw a Soweto sign, the size that might say picnic area 1 mile. And on the other side of a hill was Soweto, as big as the San Fernando Valley, a vast expanse of little homes. It was not such a terrible-looking place, by third-world standards. It was littered and scruffy and crowded, but most of the houses looked like what you'd see on an American Indian reservation. Each modest dwelling was set on a small plot of land. There was electricity and no raw sewage stink. Soweto was almost rich, as riches are measured in Africa, and there was plenty of economic power here for political power to grow out of it, if that were the way things worked in South Africa. But it wouldn't have mattered if each of those houses had been Graceland. People would be just as oppressed. South Africa is one of the few places I've ever been where things are not a matter of dollars and cents. I locked my car doors, adjusted my necktie, and drove through the place in a sweat. Soweto is like discovering arithmetic. It is an epiphany about what 83% of the population means. Until then, I hadn't seen the blacks in South Africa. Not really. Not even in the overpopulated homelands. Now they pressed in on every side in the slow jam of bicycles, trucks, and foot traffic. I hoped I had something in my wallet, some leftover receipt from a United Negro College Fund donation, or some damn thing to save my pink ass when the comrades got to me. Everyone was staring in my windows. Everyone in the crowd was looking at my pale, stupid face. And then I saw that they were smiling. And here and there was a happy wave. There was laughter from the little kids. I drove through Soweto for nearly an hour without so much as a bad look tossed in my direction, let alone rocks or firebombs. Maybe I'd caught them by surprise and they didn't know what to make of me. Maybe they thought I was so crazy to be there that it was funny. I didn't know. Months after I got back, I was giving a lecture on journalism at some little college in the middle of Pennsylvania, and I told the students about driving through Soweto. One of them came up to the lectern afterward. She was from Soweto, an exchange student.
"Don't you know why the people were smiling and waving at you?" she said. "They thought you were great."
"But why?"
"It's illegal for you to be there. How did you ever get in?"
I don't know. I was lost. I came in through some back roads.
The government isn't letting anyone in there, and when people saw you, that you had managed to get in some way, they figured you must be somebody good, an organizer, or from some international group, that you would even be there.
Even though I was white.
Because you were white.
There is some hope for South Africa, for the souls of the people there anyway. I mean, personally, if I'd lived my 40 years in Soweto, and I saw some unprotected honky cruising down my street on a Saturday afternoon, I would have opened that car door like an oyster and deep fat fried me on the spot.
Through Darkest America, Epcot Center. May 1983. At Epcot Center, the Disney Corporation has focused its attention on two things greatly in need of Disneyfication: the tedious future and the annoying whole wide world. Once, the future promised weekend tours of Jupiter, 200-mile-per-hour Pontiac shaped like tropical fish, and happy robots making every kid's bed. The world beyond our shores was a wonderland of oddball plants and animals, peopled by folks in interesting colors who lived in Taj Mahals and trees. Today, the future is a quagmire of microchips. They'll connect your television to somebody's typewriter, and if you can't score a million at Donkey Kong, you'll be out of work. Meanwhile, the rest of the world has become a jumble of high-rises, from which pour mobs of college students headed for our embassies with Kindling and Bix. Mickey, Donald, Goofy, to the rescue! Give us hope! Give us joy! Give us funny mouse ears, anyway, to wear while we man the ramparts of civilization. Alas, it's not to be. Walt is dead, and after a couple of hours at Epcot, you'll wish you were too. Epcot Center is one element in the vast Central Florida complex, where Disney is attempting to remedy America's chronic leisure surplus. The whole is twice as large as Manhattan Island. Epcot itself is almost the size of Central Park. Five big American corporations sponsor pavilions in the future world half of Epcot Center. I was expecting wonders. I'm a fan of big American corporations. At least I used to be. I thought they embodied that true basis of the American character, utopian greed. Their vision of the future always combined mercantile rapacity with such courageous lack of common sense. Hey, Dad, can I have the keys to the autogyro? I guess I'm out of date. Instead of miracles, each pavilion has a mechanical ride that whisks you through darkened scenes full of robots, which have even less personality than human actors. Every ride seems to begin with cavemen and end in a video game, where a recorded voice asks you to face the challenges of tomorrow. I thought that's what we're paying these corporations to do. In between the automat Neanderthals and the tepid splatter of strobe effects is the briefest, most bowdlerized, most fact-free possible exposition of something that has something to do with something that corporation vends. It's non-education in the guise of unentertainment, and there's not even a good sales pitch to excuse it. The Bell System's Spaceship Earth is, I suppose, the best of the lot. You're trundled around inside the immense wiffle ball that's Epcot's trademark and exposed to tableau mort, showing glimpses of communications technology from mud to the modern day. The last scene is a nightmarish vault filled with blasting, flashing television screens. I thought this brought the point home nicely that it doesn't matter how elaborate a communication system is when there's nothing to communicate. General Motors has something called the World of Motion that should properly be titled Ride the Wild Ironies. In the first place, they propel you through their robot show in form of mass rail transit. And the tram cars are all too much like current GM automobiles. Small, slow, and made out of plastic. Also, the ride keeps coming to a halt, caught in some mid-exhibit traffic jam. Furthermore, General Motors tries to make its history of transportation comic at a moment when the U.S. auto industry is just not a laughing matter. It's interesting to see what the members of a corporate board can agree upon as funny. At GM, funny is round, puffy faces and great big behinds, though other outsized body parts will do. We're shown a cave family with very swollen feet. They had to walk, you see. And there's a group of caravan travelers being overcharged by a fellow with a huge, hooked nose. I hope no one thinks this is anti-Semitic, not after all the trouble GM went to making 15% of their robots black, whether black people belong in the scenes or not. No, there aren't any outsized male parts visible. Exxon's universe of energy tends to the peculiar rather than the humorous. There are no markings on the entrance doors. You mill around outside the Exxon monolith until they agree to let you in. Then you're made to stand in a large, dim hall while an incomprehensible film montage about wind and sun and rain and strip mines is shown on a wall. Another such montage is endured inside a theater. When it ends, the blocks of theater seats start moving around in a most disconcerting way. After 2 or 3 minutes of mechanical confusion, the seats locomote through a short tunnel filled with clockwork dinosaurs. The dinosaurs are depicted without accuracy and much too close to your face. One of the few real novelties at Epcot is the use of smell to aggravate illusions. Of course, no one knows what dinosaurs smelled like, but Exxon has decided they smelled bad. At the other end of Dino Ditch, the seats rearrange themselves, and there's a final, very addled message about facing challengehood tomorrow-wise. I dozed off during this, but the import seems to be that dinosaurs don't have anything to do with energy policy, and neither do you. If you have the right attitude, these exhibits are swell. They're tilt-a-whirls for intellectuals. They excite all kinds of thrilling mental terror about the banality of American thought, electrify you with horror at the myopia of corporate perspective, and create marvelous suspense as you consider what's in store for our society now that we've lost not only our visionary capacities, but even our simple avarice. I mean, why can't you buy a Mickey Mouse phone in the Bell Pavilion? Maintaining the right attitude is a chore, however, and one I abandoned after the intensely stupid Kodak Journey into the Imagination. Epcot Center is a family attraction, so I didn't expect to see the things that occupy my own imagination. Still, Kodak could have done better than this jumble of redundant Jules Verne machine parts blowing colored bubbles through chemistry-set tubing and dangling crude unicorn cutouts from the walls. The nation that produced Mormon theology, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Reagan administration's economic policy deserves more. There is supposed to be an interesting 3D movie somewhere at Kodak, but I was desperate to get out of the place. It was 20 degrees hotter inside than it was in the midday sun. Like the rest of the buildings in Future World, the Kodak Pavilion's sleek functionalism is for strictly decorative purposes. Even a company with as little imagination as Kodak should know better than to have a greenhouse roof in Florida. The remaining pavilion is sponsored by Kraft. It's called The Land, and I can't tell you what goes on in there. I stepped inside and didn't see anything made from an organic substance. This included their food. I didn't go on the ride for fear they'd make me eat some of it. All these exhibits seemed more involved with literal than figurative tomorrows. They're as up-to-date as next Monday. Visiting Future World is like opening a Chinese fortune cookie to read, "Soon you'll be finished with dinner." The other half of Epcot Center is called World Showcase, and it consists of 9 national pavilions arranged around a phony lake. An objective look at the world as presented here results in these conclusions. Earth is made of cement, painted to look like different parts of Los Angeles, and its salient feature is overpriced gift shops. Mexico's gift shop is housed in a vividly bogus Mayan temple. The sales floor is supposed to represent a Mexican marketplace. Seeing a Mexican marketplace portrayed as clean, quiet, safe, and expensive is somehow as alarming as seeing a pyramid of human skulls in downtown Kansas City. A clean, quiet, safe, and expensive Germany is, on the other hand, soporiferously convincing. For a moment, I thought I was in Germany. I left as quickly as I could. Italy has so little to do with things Italian that I wonder if maybe this isn't some kind of revolving exhibit that on other days of the week is labeled Belgium, Seattle, and Sydney, Australia. The only interesting pavilion is mainland China's. They used some real wood and real ceramics in their reproduction of an ancient Peking temple. And they have a pretty movie about China's big weird landscape. Political points are deftly made. How wonderful it must have been when everyone could first enter the Forbidden City. But I'm not sure I want to live in a world where Exxon needs to take lessons from the Chi-Com hordes who murdered our boys at the Yalu. Also, their movie is shown in 360 degrees, which assumes we white devils have an extra set of eyes on the back of our ears. America, has accurately horrible food and inaccurately horrible young people, dressed as members of the Continental Congress and singing Turkey in the Straw. I don't know why Mickey Mouse isn't in the France exhibit. You see him all over Paris, where he is considered an existential figure of stature equal to Camus or Jerry Lewis. But it was worth Epcot's $15 admission ticket to see a glass of lait on a French menu. Japan has the best gift shop. Canada is surely indulging in a bit of good-natured self-mockery with a national display so dull that its centerpiece is a one-quarter scale replica of the Chateau Frontenac, a second-rate luxury hotel built in Quebec City in the 1920s. I picked up one of the toys for sale at the United Kingdom Pavilion. I leave it to your imagination where it was made. With Epcot Center, the Disney Corporation has accomplished something I didn't think possible in today's world. They have created a land of make-believe that's worse than regular life. Unvarnished reality would be preferable. In fact, it might be fun. United Kingdom could feature green-haired teenagers wearing diaper pins through their lips and spray-painting swastikas on the fake bullseye pub windows. France could be manned by snarling Parisian garçons, bullying the naive tourists into ordering peeled mice in heavy cream. America could be the very stretch of highway through Kissimmee, Florida, that leads to Epcot's gates. 1,000 Dairy Queens, RV parks, peewee golf establishments, and souvenir stands selling Cypress knee clocks and shellacked blowfish. All the Mexicans next door could be trying to sneak in. We could buy cars from General Motors, gas up at Exxon, and drive over to the Bell system where, if they have any sense, they'll give us free whiskey so we'll make 9-hour phone calls to old girlfriends in Taos. When we've spent all our money doing this, we could go to Kraft and get free government surplus cheese food substances. And if Disney still wants to make Epcot Center futuristic, they could do so by blowing the place up with an atom bomb. Among the Euro Weenies. April through May, 1986. The Europeans are going to have to feather their nests with somebody else's traveler's checks this year. The usual flock of American pigeons is crapping on statues elsewhere. Sylvester Stallone canned the Cannes Film Festival. Prince won't tour this side of the sink. The U.S. Junior Wimbledon team is keeping its balls on the home court, and transatlantic rubberneck bookings have taken a dive. Some say it's fear of terrorism. Some say it's Chernobyl fallout. Some say it's the weak dollar. But all of that ignores one basic fact. This place sucks. I've been over here for one gray, dank spring month now, and I think I can tell you why everyone with an IQ bigger than his hat size hit the beach at Ellis Island. Say what you want about land of opportunity and purpled mountains majesty above the fruited plain. Our forebears moved to the United States because they were sick to death of lukewarm beer and lukewarm coffee and lukewarm bathwater and lukewarm mystery cutlets with mucky-colored mushroom cheese junk on them. Everything in Europe is lukewarm except the radiators. You could use the radiators to make party ice, but nobody does. I'll bet you could walk from the Ural Mountains to the beach at Biarritz and not find one rock-hard, crystal-clear, fist-sized American ice cube. Ask for whiskey on the rocks, and you get a single, gray, crumbling leftover from some Lilliputian puddle freeze plopped in a thimble of scotch, for which you're charged like sin. And the phones don't work. They go blat-blat and neek-neek and oogu-oogu-oogu. No two dial tones are alike. The busy signal sounds as if the phone is ringing. And when the phone rings, you think the dog farted. All the light switches in Europe are upside down. The electrical plugs are terrifying with 9 or 12 huge, nasty prongs. And you'd better wear rubber boots if you come within a yard of them, because house current here is about 100,000 volts. Not that that makes the appliances work. This electric typewriter I'm pounding, for instance, I'd throw it out the window, but it's one of those silly European windows that, when you push it open from the right, comes around from the left and smacks you in the back of the head. The Europeans can't figure out which side of the road to drive on, and I can't figure out how to flush their toilets. Do I push the knob, or pull it, or twist it, or pump it? And I keep cracking my shins on that stupid bidet thing. Memo to Europeans, try washing your whole body. Believe me, you'd smell better. Plus, there are ruins everywhere. The Italians have had 2,000 years to fix up the Forum, and just look at the place. I've had it with these dopey little countries and all their pokey borders. You can't swing a cat without sending it through customs. Everything's too small. The cars are too small. The beds are too small. The elevators are the size of broom closets. Even the languages are itty-bitty. Sometimes you need two or three just to get you through till lunch. It's not like the Europeans have been very nice hosts either. The whole month here has been one long shower of shit about America, just because we took a punch at the Libyans. There were huge demonstrations in Germany, Italy, and Spain. In West Berlin, 20,000 young bucketheads turned out. In Barcelona, a group of protesters vented their fury on that symbol of American imperialism, a McDonald's. In London, thousands of peacemongers blocked the main shopping thoroughfare of Oxford Street, staging sit-down strikes and throwing bottles at the police. Thousands more Brits came out to holler in Manchester, Cardiff, and Glasgow, and at the military bases on the Clyde and in Oxfordshire. According to various opinion polls, 66% of the British deplored our behavior, as did 75% of the West Germans, 32% of the French, and 60% of the Italians. In Belgium, a friend of mine was stopped on the street by a policeman and told he should be ashamed to be an American. The cover story of Time Out, London's equivalent to New York magazine, was "Overarmed, Overeager, Over Here." A British TV comedy program showed a puppet skit with President Reagan as the Jordanian, who tried to blow up an LL airliner, and Mrs. Thatcher as the dimbulb pregnant Irish girl duped into carrying the explosives. The New Statesman ran an editorial explaining how U.S. defense policy can be understood only in light of American football. Defense, to the average redneck, it said, means hitting your opponent hard before he sees the ball. An article in the magazine New Socialist said that in the U.S. worldview, non-Americans are simply not people, claimed that to be president, you have to be mad or an actor, and asked itself, does not the United States need a hostile relationship with the Soviet Union to contain discontent at home? Another article in the same magazine began, "It is the United States which is clearly the greatest evil to people seeking just rights of self-determination." New Socialist is not, by the way, some nut-fudge fringe publication like it would be in the States. It's the official organ of the Labor Party. As Paris Match put it, "Le point de vue européen état différent est une non-responsable plaidant pour une action plus discrète." Whatever that means. Actually, the only discrete people I've met here were Libyans, the employees of Libyan Arab Airlines in Paris, who never referred to our rocketing and bombing each other as anything but this difficult situation. I was talking to the Libyans because I never wanted to go to Europe in the first place. I was headed for Tripoli. It was a dream byline, from our correspondent on the line of death. But daily life kept getting in the way. Taxes were due. I owed a 4,000-word story to Gerbil and Pet Mouse Monthly. My girlfriend was restive. She pointed out I'd forgotten Christmas, and that when I'd taken her out for New Year's, I'd taken her out in the backyard to blow off M-80s onto the garbage cans. I set to work with a will, emptying checkbooks, wrestling accountants, interviewing small rodents, scouring the bargain bin at Cartier's. By Monday, April 14th, I had everything paid, written, kissed, made up, and in the mail. My safari jacket was packed, my tape recorder loaded. I zipped shut my official foreign correspondent duffel bag, fixed myself a drink, and flipped on the 11 o'clock news. Boom! My friend Charles Glass, ABC TV's Middle East correspondent, was holding a telephone receiver out a window of the Grand Hotel in Tripoli. "We're not sure exactly what's going on," shouted Glass at the phone. I was. Those weren't the Nicaraguan Contras out there pounding Mad Mo, the terror-bombing Sheik of Shriek. "It would appear that the United States has launched a military action against Libya," shouted Glass, trying to sound grave. But you could hear the boyish enthusiasm creeping into his voice, the way it always does when a reporter manages to get himself right smack dab in the middle of something god-awful. I could have cried. I did cry. I threw things. I took the first plane to Paris. Paris had the nearest Libyan embassy, or People's Bureau, or whatever they're calling them. It looked like military school the way I'd pictured it when my parents used to threaten to send me there. I made four trips to this forbidding crib before somebody there told me the only way I could get a visa to go to Tripoli was to go to Tripoli. I went back to my hotel and got on the worthless, static-filled French telephone. Air France wasn't flying to Libya just then. British Airways definitely wasn't. Swiss Air was coy. Maybe they were, and maybe they weren't. I finally got a reservation on Lufthansa, rushed to their office, and handed over $1,000 worth of funny-colored French bumwad. The ticket agent said, "You have a visa?" My visa is waiting for me in Tripoli. We cannot take you to Tripoli without a visa. I can't get a visa without going to Tripoli.
You can get a visa in Tripoli?
Right.
But we cannot take you there.
Why not?
You don't have a visa.
You can always reason with a German. You can always reason with a barnyard animal, too, for all the good it does. I didn't figure an American would be very welcome on the Libyan flag carrier at the moment, unless he wanted to travel naked and in a muzzle. But it was worth a try. I went to the Libyan Arab Airlines office on the Champs-Élysées. There were half a dozen Libyans inside. I picked out a young one behind the counter and began explaining with many worried hand gestures how I had been told by my editor of a very important magazine to go directly to Libya, no matter what, and now I was stranded in this faraway country among foreigners and could not seem to get to Libya by any means, etc.
"Oh, my goodness," said the young man, "and right now there is this..."
He paused and considered the delicacy of my feelings.
"This difficult situation."
I'd hate to have to explain this to anyone who was on the Achille Lauro, but Arabs are the sweetest-natured people on earth. To meet an Arab is to gain a devoted friend. If you even make eye contact with an Arab, you've got a pal for life.
"Would you like some coffee?"
said the young man. The other Libyans pulled up their chairs and offered cigarettes, but there was one, with sharp clothes and an equally sharp face, who eyed me narrowly. He said,
"What kind of journalistic story is it that you wish to do?"
Well, he had me there. I'd never given it a thought. I just figured, what with guns going off and things blowing up, there'd be plenty of deep truths and penetrating insights. Tragedy and strife produce these things in boxcar lots, as any good reporter knows. Also, I wanted a chance to wear my new safari jacket. You really look like a twink if it isn't adequately dirty and sweat-stained. I said, "I'd like to do a cultural piece." Cultural piece is a key phrase for foreign correspondents. It means you aren't going to poke into any political leader's Luxembourg bank account or try to find out if his wife has 10,000 pairs of Maud Frison pumps in the palace basement.
"There is a great lack of understanding between the Arab world and the United States just now," said the young man behind the counter.
"There sure is," I said.
"Why do you think this is?"
said the sharp dresser. The truthful answer would have been, because one by one and man to man, Arabs are the salt of the earth, generous, hospitable, brave, wise, and so forth. But get you in a pack and shove a Koran down your pants, and you act like a footlocker full of glue-sniffing civet cats. We're a frank people, we Americans, but not quite that frank. I decided to blame it on Paul Newman. "It's because of Exodus," I said. Exodus was a very popular movie in the United States. Ever since this movie, all Americans think everyone in Israel is kind and good and looks like Paul Newman.
"Hmm," said the Libyans. It made sense to them. "I will call my uncle," said the sharp dresser. "He is an important man at the embassy in Rome."
"I will call the embassy here,"
said someone else.
"I will book a flight,"
said the young man behind the counter, and he got me more coffee. The only decent coffee I'd had since I left New York, by the way. The Libyan Arab Air people squared everything with the Ministry of Information in Tripoli, got me a ticket for that Friday, and told their airport manager at Orly to take me under his wing. All to no avail, however. Come Friday, the French government decided to expel four Libyan diplomats, and I was bumped off the plane. In the meantime, I was stuck in Paris. A lot of people get all moist and runny at the mention of this place. I don't get it. It's just a big city, no dirtier than most. It does have nice architecture because the French chickened out of World War II, but it's surrounded by the most depressing ring of lower middle-class suburbs this side of Smolensk. In fact, one of these suburbs is actually named Stalingrad, which goes to show that the French have learned nothing about politics since they guillotined all the smart people in 1793. French women, whether pretty or not, all walk around with their noses in the air, and pretty big noses they usually are. I guess this is what's meant by their sense of style.
Where did this sense of style thing get started? The French are a smallish, monkey-looking bunch, and not dressed any better, on average, than the citizens of Baltimore. True, you can sit outside in Paris and drink little cups of coffee, but why this is more stylish than sitting inside and drinking large glasses of whiskey, I don't know. I was exhausted the night I arrived and couldn't think of any place to go except Harry's